Chapter 10. They did what they could at the scene, but it was useless. Nendick just lay on the kitchen floor, not moving, not really conscious, but not really unconscious either. He was in some kind of a fugue state, like suspended animation. He was pale and damp with perspiration. His breathing was shallow, his pulse was weak. He was responsive to touch and light, but nothing else. An hour later, he was in a guarded room at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center with a tentative diagnosis of psychosis-induced catatonia. "Paralyzed with fear, in layman's language," the doctor said. "It's a genuine medical condition. We see it most often in superstitious populations like Haiti or parts of Louisiana. Voodoo country, in other words. The victim gets cold sweats, pallor, loss of blood pressure, near unconsciousness. Not the same thing as adrenaline-induced panic. It's a neurogenic process. The heart slows, the large blood vessels in the abdomen take blood away from the brain. Most voluntary function shuts down."
"What kind of threat could do that to a person?" Froelich asked quietly.
"One that the person sincerely believes," the doctor answered. "That's the key. The victim has to be convinced. My guess is, his wife's kidnappers described to him what they would do to her if he talked. Then your arrival triggered a crisis because he was afraid he would talk. Maybe he even wanted to talk, but he knew he couldn't afford to. I wouldn't want to speculate about the exact nature of the threat against his wife."
"Will he be okay?" Stuyvesant asked.
"Depends on the condition of his heart. If he tends toward heart disease, he could be in serious trouble. The cardiac stress is truly enormous."
"When can we talk to him?"
"No time soon. Depends on him, basically. He needs to come around."
"It's very important. He's got critical information." The doctor shook his head.
"Could be days," he said. "Could be never."
They waited a long, fruitless hour, during which nothing changed. Nendick just lay there inert, surrounded by beeping machines. He breathed in and out, but that was all. So they gave it up and left him there and drove back to the office in the dark and the silence, regrouped in the windowless conference room, and faced the next big decision.
"Armstrong's got to be told," Nagley said. "They've staged their demonstration. No place to go now except stage the real thing."
Stuyvesant shook his head. "We never tell them. It's a rigid policy. Has been for 101 years. We're not going to change it now."
"Then we should limit his exposure,"
Froelich said.
"No," Stuyvesant said. "That's an admission of defeat in itself, and it's a slippery slope. We pull out once, we'll be pulling out forever, every single threat we get, and that must not happen. What must happen is that we defend him to the best of our ability. So we start planning now. What are we defending against? What do we know?"
"That two men are already dead,"
Froelich replied.
"Two men and one woman," Reacher said.
"Look at the statistics. Kidnapped is the same thing as dead 99 times in 100.
"The photographs were proof of life," Stuyvesant said, "until the poor guy delivered, which he did almost 2 weeks ago. He's still delivering. He's not talking, so I'm going to keep on hoping."
Reacher said nothing.
"Know anything about her?"
Nagley said.
Stuyvesant shook his head. "Never met her. Don't even know her name. I hardly know Nendick either. He's just some technical guy I sometimes see around."
The room went quiet.
"FBI has got to be told as well," Nagley said. "This isn't just about Armstrong now. There's a kidnapped victim dead or in serious danger. That's the Bureau's jurisdiction, no question. Plus the interstate homicide, that's their bag too."
The room stayed very quiet. Stuyvesant sighed and looked around at each of the others, slowly and carefully, one at a time.
"Yes," he said. "I agree. It's gone too far. They need to know. God knows. I don't want to, but I'll tell them. I'll let us take the hit. I'll hand everything over to them."
There was silence. Nobody spoke. There was nothing to say. It was exactly the right thing to do in the circumstances. Approval would have seemed sarcastic, and commiseration wasn't appropriate. For the Nendick couple and two unrelated families called Armstrong, maybe, but not for Stuyvesant.
"Meanwhile, we'll focus on Armstrong," he said. "That's all we can do."
Tomorrow is North Dakota again,
Froelich said.
More open-air fun and games. Same place as before. Not very secure. We leave at 10.
And Thursday?
Thursday is Thanksgiving Day. He's serving turkey dinners in a homeless shelter here in D.C. He'll be very exposed.
There was a long moment of silence. Stuyvesant sighed again, heavily, and placed his hands palm down on the long wooden table.
Okay, he said. Be back in here at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. I'm sure the Bureau will be delighted to send over a liaison guy.
Then he levered himself upright and left the room to head back to his office, where he would make the calls that would put a permanent asterisk next to his career.
I feel helpless, Froelich said. I want to be more proactive.
Don't like playing defense?
He asked. They were in her bed, in her room. It was larger than the guest room, prettier, and quieter because it was at the back of the house. The ceiling was smoother, although it would take angled sunlight to really test it, which would happen at sunset instead of in the morning, because the window faced the other way. The bed was warm. The house was warm. It was like a cocoon of warmth in the cold, gray city night.
Defense is okay, she said. But attack is defense, isn't it? In a situation like this? But we always let things come to us. Then we just run away from them. We're too operational. We're not investigative enough.
You have investigators, he said, like the guy who watches the movies. She nodded against his shoulder.
The Office of Protection Research. It's a strange role, kind of academic rather than specific, strategic rather than tactical.
So do it yourself. Try a few things.
Like what?
We're back to the original evidence, with Nendik crapping out, so we have to start over. You should concentrate on the thumbprint.
It's not on file.
Files have glitches. Files get updated. Prints get added. You should try again every few days. And you should widen the search. Try other countries. Try Interpol.
I doubt if these guys are foreign.
But maybe they're Americans who traveled. Maybe they got in trouble in Canada or Europe or Mexico or South America.
Maybe.
And you should check the thumbprint thing as an M.O., you know, search the databases to see if anybody ever signed threatening letters with their thumb before. How far back do the archives go?
To the dawn of time.
So put a 20-year limit on it. I guess way back at the dawn of time, plenty of people signed things with their thumbs.
She smiled sleepily. He could feel it against his shoulder.
Before they learned to write, he said.
She didn't reply. She was fast asleep, breathing slow, snuggled against his shoulder. He eased his position and felt a shallow dip on his side of the mattress. He wondered if Joe had made it. He lay quiet for a spell, and then craned his arm up and switched out the light.
Seemed like about a minute and a half later they were up again and showered, and back in the Secret Service conference room eating donuts and drinking coffee with an FBI liaison agent named Bannon. Reacher was in his Atlantic City coat, and the third of Joe's abandoned Italian suits, and the third somebody in somebody's shirt and a plain blue tie. Froelich was in another black pantsuit. Nagley was in the same suit she had worn on Sunday evening. It was the one that showed off her figure, the one that Nendik had ignored. She was cycling through her wardrobe as fast as the hotel laundry would let her. Stuyvesant was immaculate in his usual Brooks Brothers. Maybe it was fresh on, maybe it wasn't. There was no way to tell. All his suits were the same. He looked very tired. Actually, they all looked very tired, and Reacher was a little worried about that. In his experience, tiredness impaired operational efficiency as badly as a drink too many.
We'll sleep on the plane, Froelich said. We'll tell the pilot to fly slow.
Bannon was a guy of about 40. He was in a tweed sport coat and gray flannels, and looked bluff and Irish, and was tall and heavy. He had a red complexion that the winter morning hadn't helped. But he was polite and cheerful, and he had supplied the donuts and the coffee himself. Two different stores, each chosen for its respective quality. He had been well received. $20 worth of food and drink had broken a lot of interagency ice.
No secrets either way, he said. That's what we're proposing, and no blame anywhere.
but no bullshit either. I think we got to face the fact that the Nendik woman is dead. We'll look for her like she wasn't, but we shouldn't fool ourselves. So we've got 3 down already. Some evidence, but not a lot. We're guessing Nendik has met with these guys, and we're assuming they've certainly been to his house, if only to grab up his wife. So that's a crime scene, and we're going over it today, and we'll share what we get. Nendik will help us, if he ever wakes up. But assuming he won't anytime soon, we'll go at it from 3 different directions. First, the message stuff that went down here in D.C. Second, the scene in Minnesota. Third, the scene in Colorado.
Are your people in charge out there?
Froelich asked. Both places, Bannon said. Our ballistics people figure the Colorado weapon for a Heckler & Koch submachine gun called the MP5.
We already concluded that, Negley said. And it was probably silenced, which makes it the MP5 SD6.
Bannon nodded. You're one of the ex-military, right? In which case you've seen MP5s before, as I have. They're military and paramilitary weapons. Police and federal SWAT teams use them, people like that.
Then he went quiet and looked around the assembled faces, like there was more to his point than he had actually articulated.
What about Minnesota?
Negley asked. We found the bullet, Bannon said. We swept the farmyard with a metal detector. It was buried about 9 inches deep in the mud, consistent with a shot from a small wooded hillside about 120 yards away to the north, maybe 80 feet of elevation.
What was the bullet? Reacher asked.
NATO, 7.62 millimeter.
Reacher nodded. You test it?
For what?
Burn?
Bannon nodded. Low power, weak charge.
Subsonic ammunition, Reacher said.
In that caliber, it has to be a VAME MK2 silenced sniper rifle.
Which is also a police and paramilitary weapon, Bannon said. Often supplied to anti-terrorist units, people like that.
He looked around the room again like he was inviting a comment. Nobody made one, so he pitched it himself.
You know what?
What?
Put a list of who buys Heckler & Koch MP5s in America side to side with a list of who buys VAME MK2s, and you see only one official purchaser on both lists.
Who?
The United States Secret Service.
The room went quiet. Nobody spoke. There was a knock at the door, the duty officer. He stood there, framed in the doorway.
Mail just arrived, he said. Something... You need to see.
They laid it on the conference room table. It was a familiar brown envelope, gummed flap, metal closure, a computer-printed self-adhesive address label. Brooke Armstrong, United States Senate, Washington, D.C. Clear, black-on-white, Times New Roman lettering. Bannon opened his briefcase and took out a pair of white cotton gloves, pulled them on right hand, left hand, tightened them over his fingers.
Get these from the lab, he said. Special circumstances. We don't want to use latex, don't want to confuse the talcum traces.
The gloves were clumsy. He had to slide the envelope to the edge of the table to pick it up. He held it with one hand and looked for something to open it with. Reacher took his ceramic knife out of his pocket and snapped it open, offered it handle first. Bannon took it and eased the tip of the blade under the corner of the flap. Moved the envelope backward and the knife forward. The blade cut the paper like it was cutting air. He handed the knife back to Reacher and pressed on the sides of the envelope so it made a mouth, glanced inside, turned the envelope over and tipped something out. It was a single sheet of letter-size paper, heavyweight white stock. It landed and skidded an inch on the polished wood and settled flat. It had a question printed over 2 lines, centered between the margins, a little higher than halfway up the sheet. 5 words in the familiar, severe typeface. Did you like the demonstration? The last word was the only word on the second line. That isolation gave it some kind of extra emphasis. Bannon turned the envelope over and checked the postmark.
Vegas again, he said. Saturday. They're real confident, aren't they? They're asking if you liked the demonstration 3 days before they staged it.
We have to move out now, Froelich said.
Lift off at 10.
I want Reacher and Nagley with me. They've been there before. They know the ground. Stuyvesant raised his hand, a vague gesture. Either okay or whatever or don't bother me. Reacher couldn't tell.